Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic, a podcast where I discuss the week's biggest TV news headlines, recap and analyze some of my favorite shows, and let you know what you should be watching. This is attempt number 5 to start this episode because I couldn't get the goddamn words TV news headlines out my mouth. Okay, so yes, this podcast is late this week. You are not crazy. I mentioned on the last episode that I was going to be doing a recap of The White Lotus season 2, so that's what we're going to get into. But first, let's talk about some news, because one of the good things about doing this podcast late is that some stuff happened today that I can talk about on Monday. First is that the Golden Globes nominations came out, and if you remember correctly, the Golden Globes were canceled for a year, literally. NBC did not air them. They give out their awards, no one cares. They're kind of like a stain now. Like, for a while it was the organization that, like, you know, they weren't really all that serious, but if people got awards, they still bragged about it. But then it came out that of the 80 something members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is the organization that puts out the Golden Globes, they had 80 something members and zero of them were Black. Which was problematic, especially coming off of 2020 and the Black Lives Matter movement and all of that stuff. So they, like, needed to do some soul searching. They spent a year doing so. And, like, I don't think they've really done even close to enough to help their cause. But they're being aired again in January on NBC. It says the HFPA worked to improve the diversity of its membership by adding 21 new journalists. Does not talk about from where or what their racial makeup is, and also strengthened its ethical rules to bar voters from accepting gifts from studios on the prowl for awards. So again, this is why not a lot of places took the Golden Globes all that seriously, is because, like, one, they're a bunch of star fuckers. They had people, they would nominate people they wanted to show up to their award ceremony to get people to watch it. So that's why you would see random winners and nominees, like when fucking Lady Gaga won an acting award for the worst season of American Horror Story. And look, Lady Gaga was wonderful in A Star Is Born. I'm not saying she's not an actress, but she was terrible on that season of Hotel. And the season of American Horror Story itself was bad. Like, it never should have happened. That was the year where, like, that meme that was heard around the world of Leonardo DiCaprio, like, making faces at her. This is what the Hollywood Foreign Press Association does. And apparently a bunch of their voters used to accept money or gifts from studios and people who wanted awards. So they also changed that. And they said they also added voters who are not members. And there are added over 100 of them. So people who, I guess that, like, that's how they're which this is, again, how fucked up is this? That rather than, like, inviting journalists of color into your organization, you're, like, adding people who are people of color who have nothing to do with journalism, which is, like, your whole gig, so that you can, like, get this diversity clout and get yourself uncanceled. Like, it's fucked up. And then after doing all of this, after adding, like, 125 new voters, it says that more than 10% of their voters are now Black. So you went from zero to, like, what is that, 12? 12? You went from 0% to 10%. This is not helping. This isn't helping. So wild that all of a sudden apparently we're caring again this year, but whatever. So they released their nominations both for TV and for movies. I'll just talk about the TV for a little bit. So the nominees for Best Television Series Drama are Better Call Saul, The Crown, House of the Dragon, Ozark, and Severance, none of which I watch. I watched one episode of Severance and I was bored silly, so okay. Best Television Series Musical or Comedy is Abbott Elementary, The Bear, Hacks, Only Murders in the Building, and Wednesday, which, like, there you go. There's your star fucking right there. Some notable nominees. Kevin Costner was nominated for Yellowstone, which I feel like, you know, the Emmys have been dancing around for a while. Diego Luna was nominated for Andor, the Star Wars series. You know, a bunch of the House of the Dragon got their first nominations. Hilary Swank got nominated for that terrible ABC show, Alaska Daily, which, like, again, starfuckers. Who else was surprising? And this isn't a surprising nomination, but, like, The White Lotus was put into the limited series categories, which, like, they're now a drama for the Emmy. So Okay. Best Limited Series, Anthology, or Motion Picture television nominations are Blackbird on Apple TV Plus, Monster, Dahmer, Jeffrey God, that fucking show will not go away. The Dropout, Pam and Tommy, and The White Lotus, which, like, again, they nominated Pam and Tommy for a bunch of stuff, and I hated that. But, you know, to each his own, I suppose. They already nominated Jessica Chastain for George and Tammy, which just premiered last week on Showtime, so that was slightly surprising. Claire Danes also got nominated for Fleischman Is in Trouble, which, again, just started. And then there were just, like, Domhnall Gleeson got nominated for The Patient, but not Steve Carell. And if you go back a few episodes, I had talked about that show. So it was just, there were some weird nominations. And, like, overall, it was just, like, they really just did not, they didn't, there are still entire categories that are completely missing people of color or shows about people of color. Look at the Best Limited Series, Anthology, or Motion Picture for Television. None of those feature Black actors or actors of color in leading roles. They do not tell the stories of people of color. Then, like, throughout the other nominations, you can see, like, there's one nominee, two nominees. Like, it's just, it's, I mean, it's just, it's baffling. Like, I'm looking at, okay, so Best Performance by an Actress, Limited Series, Anthology Series, or Motion Picture Made for TV is five white women. You know, and, like, in a year like this, we don't need that. Like, there was a lot of really interesting storytelling happening. I don't know. It's very weird. I don't know why they decided that they were, or that whoever decided they were uncanceled, that they were uncanceled. But, I mean, there we go. And then the other piece of news this week is that Drag Race Season 15 is going to premiere on Friday, January 6th, and it's going to be moving from VH1 to MTV. You know, they're like sister series or sister networks, but I think MTV is in a few more houses than VH1 is because of the way the cable packages work out. And they also announced that they are going to be expanding into Brazil, Mexico, and Germany for new seasons of International Drag Race. And the biggest announcement, I think, of this whole thing is that they're starting a new series called Global All Stars, which has a very unfortunate acronym, GAS, which I don't know if this is replacing Versus the World, which I just talked about last week. I would assume it is, and that's great. It's going to be on Paramount Plus rather than on WOW Presents Plus, so it will increase the audience or the availability, so that's great. And they didn't announce any specifics about who is eligible for this. I would hope that it includes English and non-English speaking countries, that I don't know if RuPaul is going to be hosting them or if other countries will. We did get an announcement earlier this year that Drag Race España season 3 is filming, I think, now. And after that's done, we're going to get an España All Stars, so maybe that will be separate from this. Maybe Versus the World be separate from this. Maybe US All Stars is separate from this. I don't know. But the rumor is that they are that they're going to be using this name, Global All Stars, to launch with All Stars 8, which allegedly features at least one Canadian queen. So all of that is very exciting. Drag Race is taking over the world. Drag is all over the world. So that's exciting. And I'm excited for season 15. We'll probably be getting promo sometime this week or next week at the very latest, if it's premiering January 6th. That is very soon. We are less than 2 weeks from Christmas, which means that we are less than 3 weeks from New Year's, which means that we are like 3.5 weeks from the new premiere and we don't have a cast list yet. So fun times, renewals and cancellations. Renewed this week was Hollywood Houselift with Jeff Lewis on Amazon Freevee. I loved season 1. Season 2 is coming soon. Canceled. Ugh. HBO Max can eat my ass. They went from being must-see, must-have streaming network to, like, if I didn't just pay for another year, I would probably be canceling it soon. Because the only things I watch on HBO Max are HBO shows. So at this point, the reason I have HBO Max is because HBO Max with ads is cheaper than HBO standalone. And I don't have to watch HBO Max commercials on HBO shows. So that's literally all I'm watching on HBO Max. The way they do commercials is fucking annoying, but then it's not worth it to buy without commercials because I watch so little of HBO Max's actual programming that it doesn't matter. like, they canceled this week Legendary, which, as you know, if you listen to this podcast, is one of my favorite shows. I look forward to it every year. It is so entertaining and so queer. And that is now gone after 3 seasons. They also just minutes ago, as I'm recording this, canceled Minx after season 2, after season 1, I forget. They canceled it. They renewed it and then they went back on the renewal and have canceled it. Like, I'm sick of them doing this. They did it with Batgirl, that movie, which was the only DC movie that I was looking forward to seeing, got canceled after being completed. Like, the movie had been shot, it was ready to go, and they didn't, rather than finishing effects and releasing it on HBO Max or theatrical or whatever, they decided to take a tax write-off. I'm sick of it. I'm tired of HBO Max and their big bag of bullshit. So anyway, also canceled this week was Monarch after 1 season on Fox, which, like, bye. They held it over for a year because they wanted it to get a bigger audience and they couldn't find an audience. And, like, I don't know if it's because no one cares about it. Like, it looked like a Nashville knockoff, but Nashville sucked in its last couple years. So who's interested in that? Plus, who wants to see Susan Sarandon in anything at this point? And they hired a bunch of, like, singers who are not known for acting, like Trace Adkins and Beth Ditto. So whatever. Bye to that. All right. Now, this is going to be a huge mess of an episode because I'm going to talk about The White Lotus season 2, and it just aired last night. I have been kind of collecting my thoughts throughout the day and as I was watching it last night, and I have a lot of feelings, which is not good for analysis, but I also have been thinking since the show started back in October about what it is saying this season. So if you remember my recap of the first season of The White Lotus, which, by the way, is my most popular episode of this podcast. It's been downloaded more than any other episode. I do not know why, but that's neither here nor there. Was very much about wealth and race and colonialism, I thought. And we get a lot of the same kinds of themes of wealth and privilege in season 2, only instead of focusing on maybe like race and colonialism, we're focusing a lot on sex and gender, which I find very interesting. You know, as a person with a degree in sexuality and gender studies, I find it very interesting. As I'm sure you can go back and listen to any episode of this podcast, I tend to talk about sexuality and gender quite often when I am analyzing things. So, like, this season was right up my alley. And overall, I found this season to be a mixed bag. In a lot of ways, I thought it was more entertaining than season 1, if only because in season 1, I thought the show went out of its way to make every single character completely unlikable. And there were, even Jennifer Coolidge's Tanya character was meant to be unlikable, but ended up being likable because of Jennifer Coolidge. I feel like they leaned into that in season 2, and she's very likable. And then there are other, like, as awful as they are, there are people we're rooting for. I wasn't rooting for anyone in season 1, except for F. Murray Abraham and the rest of the people who worked at the hotel. And so they were kind of like making some of the guests this time around more likable. So I think that made me care more about the show. So, all right, this is where it's going to get a mess because I'm going to try to like summarize really quickly what this season was. Because there wasn't really a whole lot of plot, which is both great and terrible for recapping because I have like no idea how to summarize the season. Okay, so we're at the White Lotus in Sicily, in Italy. And a bunch of people once again are on vacation. So we're following a family of 3 generations of men, a grandfather, a father, and a son. The grandfather is Bert, played by F. Murray Abraham. The son is Dom, and he's played by Michael Imperioli. And then the son is Albie, who is played by Adam DeMarco. And the grandfather wants to take this vacation before he's too old to travel. And he wants to find his family's roots. Now, I am Italian American. My grandfather, as I mentioned in our Italian Christmas Memories episode, was fresh off the boat. So I am Italian, but I am not Sicilian. I am from Northern Italy. But regardless, this is a thing. I don't know if this is a thing with all ethnicities or if it's just within Italian Americans, but we are very big with like going and finding our ancestral homeland in Italy. And so this was very relatable and believable to me that Bert would want to do this. And also that it would go terribly, because of course it would. So Bert is older. He's very old school. His favorite movie is The Godfather. They go to the place where The Godfather was filmed and the museum and all that shit. And he's like a womanizer. He's an old guy, but he loves to flirt. But then he's also accident prone. So that's funny. And then his son Dominic, we can see that womanizing kind of rubbing off on Dominic, because Dominic is like a sex addict and he works in Hollywood as a producer. And he's trying to mend his relationship with, I don't know if it's his wife or his ex-wife, but Albie's mother. And he's trying to like get back into her good graces, but he fucked it up because he cheated. And then we find out very early that while he is in Sicily, he has, before they even arrived, hired the services of an escort named Lucia, who we'll get to. Then Albie just graduated Stanford. He's like very... I'm going to use this word, and I don't mean it in the derogatory way that you probably hear all the time. He's very woke. And by that, I do mean that, like, he is aware. He knows, he understands gender and sexual politics, and he's very careful about them. He is empowered. He's a feminist, which also makes him a little socially awkward, and we'll get to that later. But he is a recent Stanford graduate. He's very friendly and sweet and charming, and again, woke, for lack of a better term. So that's one family. Then we have Tanya, the return of Jennifer Coolidge, who is back and is on vacation with her now husband, Greg, who she met at the end of season one in Hawaii. And she is there with her new assistant, Portia, played by Haley Lou Richardson, who is young and Gen Z in all the worst ways and super awkward, super like insecure and needs to be taken care of and constantly coddled and given direction. She's annoying as all fuck. Then we have two couples who are vacationing together, Ethan and Harper, who are married. Ethan is a tech guy whose company just like fell into a huge amount of money. And his college friend Cameron, who is also rich, has invited him and his wife, Harper, on this vacation with Cameron and his wife, Daphne. And they have a very strange, but a marriage that works for them, where Daphne is aware of how often Cameron is unfaithful to her. And she like doesn't care because she's like, I'm living my life. I have my kids and we have an arrangement, you know, like we're happy together. We don't ask questions. We don't get upset about things. And then like kind of like maybe implied that her kids aren't her kids. Maybe I'm reading too much into that, but whatever. She's very sweet, but also like very manipulative. She's a stay-at-home mom. She doesn't have a lot of friends because she thinks they're all jealous of her. Very interesting dynamics, because Harper is like very standoffish. She's very suspicious of Cameron and Daphne and people with money in general, which like good for you, bitch. You should be suspicious of people with money. They're all fucking crazy. And it's kind of like what she learns over the course of the vacation. And like when I said that there are people that we like and relate to, Harper 100% ride or die for Aubrey Plaza as Harper. She is my new best friend. Also, I want to marry her. She is everything. Bow down to Harper. I love her. And Aubrey Plaza in this role was perfection. Give her an Emmy. We give Oscars for movies. I don't care. Give her an Oscar for this too. Just give her all the awards. I love her. So that's who we have vacationing. Then we're also introduced to, again, the front desk receptionist who, like F. Murray Abraham's character in the first season, it kind of gives us the the glimpse behind the curtain of how the White Lotus is run. Her name is Valentina, played by Serena Impacciatore, and she is very snappy. And like, she is kind of rude, but hysterical. My favorite scene of the whole season is, which again, I'm going to come back to this as well. Jennifer Coolidge and her Tanya and her husband, Greg, decide to like, she wants to have her Sicilian fantasy. So like they get on the back of a moped and he drives her around the, up the coast, and she smokes cigarettes on the back of a Vespa. And she says to Valentina, "Guess who I am?" And she smokes a cigarette and she's like wearing this like frilly pink muumuu. And Valentina goes, "Peppa Pig." Jennifer Coolidge goes, "No, I'm Monica Vitti." And it's just, it's so fucking funny. And then Valentina takes her picture. It's just like, that is the rudest thing you could say, but also hysterical. And she eventually, over the course of the season, comes out as gay. And then we also see working class people in this season, Lucia and Mia, who are Italian locals, who are both like hustlers and sex workers. Like Mia, I don't think is actually a sex worker in the first episode, but eventually like turns to it because Lucia like talks her into doing threesomes for money and stuff like that. But Mia really wants to be a singer. So she's like angling to be the piano bar singer, and she eventually gets it in the finale. Whereas Lucia is just an escort. She is the escort that Dom hooks up with in the first season. And she kind of like works her way through the cast throughout the rest of the season. And there we have it. Then we also later meet Quentin, who is a gay English expat, I guess you could call him, who has a yacht and a house in Palermo. And he loves Tanya, and he's traveling with his nephew Jack, who is from Essex and has the most annoying accent I've ever heard in my entire life. And I have never been less attracted to a man in my entire life, even though I'm supposed to find him hot. I wanted to vomit and kill myself every time he was on screen, but anyway, who get involved with Tanya and Portia. So like, it's a very complex web of people, but there's not a whole lot that goes on, you know, like, it takes three episodes, and then Harper and Daphne go away together for a night to a local town while Ethan and Cameron stay behind and like do drugs and have sex with hookers. Well, Cameron does, Ethan doesn't. Or like, you know, we see Lucia move from Dominic to Cameron to Albie. We see Mia talking to Valentina, wanting to get the piano playing job. So she tries to seduce the piano player and then fills in for him. And like, we see Tanya meeting Quentin and then going on a boat ride and then going to the opera and being at his villa. And then, so like, they do these like small things, but like it moves so slowly, which is great because we get to know these people. And as you can probably tell, I just spent at least 10 minutes describing who they were. So like, who they are is very important to the story and to the themes, but not a lot happens, except that once again, we start the season with a dead body. And honestly, my biggest hope for season three is that we drop that, because I do not need the like specter of a dead body hanging over me, because in a lot of ways that took away from my enjoyment of the subtler and more artistic things that the White Lotus was doing this season, because I kept thinking like, holy shit, we have one more episode left and someone's going to die. And it could be literally anyone. And like, looking for clues to who was going to die detracted from the actual characterizations that were happening. So I kind of hope we don't have a murder mystery in season three. I know that like would change the format of the show, but that's what I am hoping for. I doubt that it'll happen based on what Mike White has said season three potentially will be about, but that's a story for later. So our way into all of these characters and their relationships is their relationships, right? Like, Lucia and Mia are sex workers. They use sex. They use their femininity. They use their bodies literally to make money, to fulfill their fantasies and their dreams, and to get what they want. And that idea pervades the whole series of like people using sex to get what they want. People use like the different ways that people of different genders view sex and use sex. Like I mentioned, the episode where Ethan and Cameron stay behind at the White Lotus while Daphne and Harper go to like this, like a villa outside, like a couple hours outside of Sicily. And Cameron has a very cavalier view of sex. And Daphne kind of has gotten used to this as well. Where like, to Cameron, sex is sex. It's something he wants, it's something he needs, it's something he desires, but it's not necessarily anything that has any emotion behind it. Like in that episode, he gets wasted, he gets high, and he has sex with Lucia and Mia. And so he has sex with hookers while he's on vacation and like doesn't think twice about it and has no guilt about it. Whereas like the guilt kind of eats at Ethan and manifests much differently. So Harper comes back and finds a condom wrapper in the couch in their room, which is not Ethan's. It's Cameron's. Ethan did nothing. He did not have sex with anyone else. But like, it's hard for Harper to believe that because she just heard and assumed all of this stuff about Cameron. And she knows that Cameron's a douchebag because earlier in the season, he like takes off his bathing suit right in front of her, knows that she sees him. He, like, she knows what a scumbag he is when it comes to this thing. So it's hard for her to imagine that he and Ethan spent a night together and did nothing. But Cameron backs Ethan's story up, so Harper starts to let it go. But then Ethan starts to suspect that something happened between Harper and Cameron while Harper was mad at him. And the way that his jealousy manifests is that he cannot let it go until Harper tells him what he wants to hear. And even though she tells him what we have to assume is the truth, that Cameron kissed her and that's it, that there's nothing else that went on, that she would not sleep with him, all this stuff, that Ethan does not believe her. So, and his reaction to hearing that is that he goes out and fights Cameron in public, almost drowns him, hits him in the face, and Cameron can get over that too. Like, Cameron is so unemotional when it comes to his attachments and his relationships. Ethan maybe is too emotional. Harper may be too emotional. Daphne and Cameron kind of have this figured out where they have a happy relationship because they don't let feelings get in the way. They enjoy themselves and that's it. And they are afforded that luxury by their wealth and their money and their whiteness. Ethan is not white. He doesn't have that luxury. So that's super interesting. Then we have Albie and Portia, who meet up and like spend time together. And Portia like complains at one point that Albie is too woke, basically, that he's like asking permission all the time and he's too gentle. And he's too in tune with her feelings. He's too soft, basically. And she wants someone who's going to take something from her, who's going to own her. And like that kind of idea of sexuality and the relationships is interesting because like that's kind of what ends up saving Harper and Ethan's marriage as well, is that Ethan has to become aggressive to reignite the spark he has with his wife. Like Harper's like, you know, you're not, when are we going to deal with the fact that you're just not attracted to me? You'd rather watch porn than have sex with me. You'd rather masturbate than have sex with your wife. And it's not until he like is aggressive with Cameron, is aggressive with Harper, maybe potentially has sex or some type of relations with Daphne when they sneak off together, that he can like, that he can have sex with his wife again. There's an ownership there that is probably very much in line with the kind of porn that he watches, that maybe is because of his obsession with porn, that like we're also commenting on that, on sex work, that like Portia, going back to Portia and Albie, very much, I think, likes the idea of a good guy like Albie, but doesn't like it in practice because she's been told what she should want out of a man. And it's someone like Jack, who is forceful and stupid, so dumb and like vulgar and gets drunk in public and but is also like in more ways conventionally attractive, but also conventionally douchey. You know, he's covered in tattoos and he like walks around with an open shirt and he pounds beers and he burps and farts and talks about how he's gonna go take a shit in public. And like that is what Portia and all girls and young women are told to be attracted to. Where Albie is like the example of what we're trying to make men into, where he is considerate and soft-spoken and he defers to Portia and he takes things slowly. He asks for permission to kiss her, to hold her hand, making sure that like he gets consent for everything. And that's what we're being told is appropriate. But then she doesn't want it. Until the very end when she realizes like, oh, there's a reason that I shouldn't be attracted to these kinds of men like Jack, and it's because they're awful. And the very last scene is her finding Albie at the airport and getting his number. Because at the end of the day, she realizes, okay, maybe the thing that's good for me is the thing that's good for me. But then we also can see how someone like Lucia can take that from that, or not take from Albie, or take from Albie, I guess, can take that innocence that Albie has and turn it into, and can see it as weakness and turn it against him, because she seduces him, she plays on his emotions, and she gets him to give her $50,000, which he gets from Dominic, and then she absconds with it in the middle of the night, and she played him the whole time. And Albie realizes it. To his credit, he does realize, oh, I got played, but it doesn't stop him from being played. Dominic tries to tell him, you're being played. He knows deep down that he's being played, but he's too good of a person to care. That like in his mind, he's like, well, I don't care, because even if I am getting played, at least I'm going to help this woman. But then that also has misogyny behind it. That like he understands what sex work is, and he's not trying to change Mia and make her not a sex worker. He accepts that she's a sex worker. And, but then he also like, part of him wants to save her and to give her this money and have her move to Los Angeles to be with him, so she doesn't, quote, have to be a sex worker anymore. So like there is a kind of like, as for all of his feminism and his female empowerment and his wokeness, he still tries to buy this woman's freedom when all along she's been free. She's been using him. She's been playing him. She's been in control of her own destiny. So like even underneath all of this, like this do-gooder, this do-gooding, this, I don't know, what do we want to call it? Where like Albie is like doing and saying what he's supposed to, and he understands better than every other male character on the show. But underneath it all, he still has that like deep-seated sexism where he needs to save this woman and be that savior for her and lift her up for, and not allow her to like be a victim of her own sex, basically. And then she ends up being like, fuck you, dude, but I'll take your money. I'm living my life the best way I know how. Thank you, sir. Have fun in Los Angeles. I'm going to play somebody else next week. Props to Mia and Lucia. And then we also get this really interesting, before I get into the big storyline with Tanya, we also get this really interesting relationship with Dom and Bert and Albie, where they all finally find their family and they go and they seek it out, and it's a compound, I guess, or a villa, or it's a home that is all women. There are no men left in this family. They've all been driven out. So when these three men show up being like, we're your family, you know, speaking English, because that's a whole nother thing that I wish this season got more into, was like kind of relating to the colonialism of season one, of this like expectation of Americans that when you go overseas, that you just speak English to people, even when they don't speak English. Like, there's a moment in the final episode where Tanya is like to an Italian person, do you speak English? And he says, no. And she still tells this whole story in English, expecting him to understand. Same thing here with this scene where these three men show up and the women make it clear they don't speak English, but they try to, they try to speak English to them anyway. Like, I wish the show got more into, like, that form of colonialism of, like, or American entitlement, where we just, like, don't even bother trying a lot of times when we go overseas, especially to resorts like the White Lotus. I know when I went overseas when I was in high school and I went to France, I tried I was with a French class. The whole point was to try to speak French. I tried very hard to speak as much French as possible. And there were places we went where I had to, because we went to like some of the less touristy places, like Saint Malo and places like that, where if you wanted to get ice cream there, those people did not speak English. If you wanted to order something, you had to know what you were ordering in French, and you had to know what they were saying back to you in French, which you could then boil it down to like what flavor and how much, and that's all you need to understand. But that was more than a lot of people who went on the trip knew. And so like when you're going to resorts, you're expecting everyone to speak English. So when you encounter someone who doesn't, it's like it goes over your head and you just keep speaking English. And that's what they do, not understanding that these women have no use for them. They do not want to know their male family, and they don't care who you are. You are men encroaching on their land and their home. So they get chased away by the matriarch holding a knife and throwing artichokes at them. And that is great. But like this tension here where the men on this show just do not understand how to relate to anyone, but especially to women. I found that fascinating. Okay. So then that there's the relationships, and like all of this is kind of tied around like art and story and these ideas of, okay, so this, I told you it was gonna be a mess. I'm trying to figure out how to like relate all this. So in the first episode and throughout the series, we see these like vases and statues of decapitated heads. And they're called something specific, and I forget the name of it. Let me see if I can remember while I'm talking. It translates to the Moor's head. And I want to say it's like Testa di Moro. My very limited understanding of Italian, I'm going to say it's Testa di More or Moro, something like that. But regardless, it's these like decapitated heads that are based on this story of a Moor coming to Sicily and seducing a young girl. And then she finds out that the Moor has a wife and children at home when he's traveling. And because he lied to her, she cuts off his head. And it's like this story about jealousy and sexuality and lying and all that stuff. And so we're kind of like suspecting the whole season that someone's going to cheat on someone and get their head cut off. Basically, that's like what I suspected the whole, because we keep seeing these fucking heads. They're in everyone's rooms. They're all over the hotel. Like we keep getting close-ups of them. They're in the middle of shots. Like it's on the table in the entryway to Harper and Ethan's hotel room. And so much of their like jealousy storyline centers that, the like, literally centers that head. Like when Ethan thinks, when Harper and Cameron kiss, or Cameron kisses Harper, and Ethan walks in, we get a frame of him walking through the door and Harper standing near the table with his head on it. So like it's central to so much of this, of these storylines, like they think people are cheating, that we think that like we're meant to assume that by the end of it, that one of the dead bodies is one of these couples and it's because they cheated. But really at the end of it, Harper and Ethan are having sex and they break the Testa di Moro, and kind of like they break away from this, the oldest story of like of sexual jealousy and cheating scandal. Like we've transcended this, maybe is the message. I don't know. There's that. There's all this art throughout the series that alludes to sex and to like gender politics. Like we see the painting of Lucretia, who was raped by, who was it? I want to say it's Ozymandias. I know that's not correct. Was raped by an emperor. I forget who. And is in all of this artwork and, Tarkin? Tarkin and Lucretia? Sextus. Yeah, the painting is Tarkin and Lucretia. Anyway, she rejects him, so he rapes her, and then she tells everyone what he did and kills herself. So we see multiple paintings of that. So like maybe someone's going to commit suicide. And like even the art, all of the art is surrounding these ideas of sex and gender, right? And then to tie it all together, we get the story of Tanya, who we love from season one. Jennifer Coolidge is a national treasure. Thank God for the show, for giving her the platform and the role that she was always meant to play to actually bring her this acclaim that everyone has been wanting to give her for years. Okay, so Tanya and Greg are on vacation. We're meant to assume at some point that Greg is cheating on her because Tanya overhears a conversation. It's all she can think about is Greg is cheating, Greg is cheating, Greg is cheating. He lies and says that he has to fly back to the States and he'll be back. We know at this point that he's lying about something. And this is when she meets these gay men from England and France who are like, oh, you're so fabulous. Come have lunch with us. I want to take you on our yacht to Palermo. We're going to take you to the opera and you're going to stay in our villa. And Quentin takes Tanya to see Madame Butterfly. Again, tragic heroine. She dies in this opera. It's kind of inevitable once you put all the pieces together that Tanya was the dead body that Daphne discovers in episode one. I was very mad as I was watching the episode because I love Tanya so much. And the way she died, I hated, but also was brilliant in its own way when you think about how Tanya is Tanya. But it was inevitable because Tanya in season one, and Mike White said in a post-mortem interview, there was a scene in season one where Tanya says, death is the last immersive experience I haven't had yet. So this was him like fulfilling Tanya's prophecy and like giving her that her last immersive experience is death, right? So Tanya is the body. This whole storyline, so Greg leaves and the Englishman and Quentin and his nephew Jack, who ends up with Portia and takes her away, separates Portia and Tanya so that Quentin, we later find out, can work Tanya because he's going to kill Tanya, or they're all going to kill Tanya. Because years ago, Quentin fell in love with a cowboy named Steve. And we find out through photos that that cowboy was Greg. And if Greg and Tanya divorce because they have a prenup, Greg gets nothing. If Tanya dies, he gets all of her money. And we know from season one that Tanya is very rich. It's why she was single most of her life. It's because she didn't trust men, thought they were after her money, right? So Greg comes up with this whole plan where Quentin and his friends are going to kill Tanya. They're going to split the money. Tanya and Portia kind of put the pieces together way too late because Tanya is Tanya. And she finds the picture of Greg and it's like, it's so weird. This guy looks just like Greg. And Quentin's like, that's Steve, the cowboy. It's uncanny. And then Portia's like, Jack stole my phone, so I'm calling on his phone. I think something bad's gonna happen. And Tanya puts the pieces together. It's like, oh, wow, a windfall, huh? Oh, Greg's trying to kill me. And then, you know, she's paranoid and the rest of the night that they won't let her off the yacht. And she starts to think, okay, my wine is poisoned. And then Niccolo, they try to get who she slept with, which I thought that was going to be the whole thing, was that like if Tanya cheats on Greg, he gets the money. But no, apparently they're trying to kill her. And she finds rope and duct tape and a gun in Niccolo's bag and then puts it together too late, but saves herself from being murdered by shooting all of the men on the boat and killing them all except for one who jumps overboard and starts to swim away. So now I'm like, oh, he jumped overboard. He's the body in the water. Well, then Tanya, bless her stupid fucking heart, tries to get into the tender, the small boat behind the yacht. And rather than going down the ladder to the loading platform, which if we all know from watching Below Deck, there is a loading platform, like the tender or is tied to the side of the boat. There's like a little platform by the ladder that you get off of to get onto the boat. And that's where the tenders are tied up. Instead of going down to that or not realizing that, she tries to climb over the side of the boat and jump into the tender. And she slips, falls, hits her head, and drowns. And Tanya is the dead body that washes up on the shore that Daphne discovers at the beginning of the first episode. Now, I was mad because, like, Tanya dying is one thing. It would be kind of absurd to continue following Tanya across multiple seasons, even though I would fucking love it. I would love nothing more for this to become like a satirical, idiotic comedy where Jennifer Coolidge just keeps going to White Lotus resorts where people are murdered and she has nothing to do with any of it. She's just there. She's just cluelessly there. That, to me, honestly, might have been a better ending, and I'm surprised Mike White didn't lean into that. And have someone else be the dead body so that Jennifer Coolidge could just show up somewhere else, like Thailand or, I don't know, like Chile or Mexico or something at a White Lotus and just have all these dead bodies piling up around her and her just like being self-absorbed in the background. I mean, like, wow, it's so weird that people always die around me. But no. Tanya dies stupidly by her own hand, which I think was also predicted at one point by a fortune teller during the season. So like the signs were all there. We were just too stupid. Not too stupid, but like I was just holding out hope that it really would not be Tanya because I love Tanya. I love her. She's so dumb, but also so self-centered. And like the fact that she died in an accident that she could have so easily prevented right after saying the words to herself, "You got this, girl." And she just like falls over the edge and hits her head and drowns. Like, it was inevitable. We had all the clues were there. The suicide from Lucretia, the Madame Butterfly, the immersive death being the last immersive experience for season one, Jennifer Coolidge's star rising because of the show. Like, the signs were all there that it was going to be Tanya. But we all held out hope that it wasn't. And then the fact that, like, the way she died was at her own hand, but unintentionally, simply because she's too self-absorbed to think, and that she's too used to having everyone do everything for her that she can't literally survive on her own. You know, like, she drops her phone in the ocean while she's trying to call for help. Like, it's all these things that are just so dumb that she puts together the pieces too late, that she sees the picture of Greg, but is like, it goes right over her head. And even as she shoots Quentin and he's dying and his lungs are filling with blood and he's spitting up blood, all she can think is Greg having an affair? She yells at Quentin, "I know you know it's Greg having an affair." That she's not even concerned that Greg had her murdered, that Greg hired someone to kill her. She's just concerned that she's being cheated on. It's so full circle and so Tanya that she's so myopic in, like, she gets her mind fixated on one thing that she can't take a second to think of a different way to get to the boat, that she tries to climb overboard and ends up dying because of it. That she just ends up dying at the hand of her own cluelessness is so Tanya and so perfect for her demise. I just wish that it wasn't her. I just wish that it wasn't her. I don't know. But it was just, there was so much texture and symbolism and, oh, like, I mean, I've just gone through a million different things about like the gender and sexual politics of the show. And I barely touched on everything that you could, like, you could fine tooth comb this, go through this show with a fine tooth comb. So I'm all over the place. So sorry. And like, again, I barely scratched the surface. Like, then there's all this water symbolism of like, you know, someone drowns and, but then also like water is rebirth. It gives life, it takes life. You know, like we had Tanya spreading her mom's ashes in the first season and then return, like, to ashes we all return. So it's very poetic. Again, the clues were all there that she was going to drown. And in that same, you know, because all the water on earth is connected and all this shit, and like that, water gives life but takes it, and that it's mesmerizing but deadly, that it's bright and beautiful and but then is so dark underneath the surface. And it's, you know, it's all the age-old symbolism of water, of Moby Dick, of the Bible, like, take your fucking pick, right? It plays into all of that. The White Lotus season 2 plays into all of that as well. And I mean, like, there's so much more art, and it has, like, when you go to a place like Italy that's so steeped in the Renaissance and, you know, like, the past and Christianity, like, there's so much symbolism with religion, and that, like, there's just a fucking crucifix or a cross hanging over the whole season because there's a little island next to the White Lotus where a woman was killed for not wanting to go up her land, and at the top of this peak is a cross that just is hanging, that is over everything. that Mia at one point tries to have sex or whatever with the piano player in a church, and she says no one ever comes here, which like is hysterical. And also, again, very much of like, we're so consumed with sex that like there's a commentary to be made there about like sex and religion, like sex rules our lives instead of religion. But isn't that always the case that these have been the two things that have always ruled our lives, is sex and religion, is the body and faith, the mind and the body, the physical and the mental, that like, and sex is the ultimate when it comes to the physical, and faith and belief is the ultimate when it comes to the metaphysical, that like, there's so much when it comes to the show, and I goddamn fucking loved it. It was so good. I've been talking about it for like 45 minutes. My apologies. But like, God, watch this fucking show if you don't. What are you waiting for? What are you doing? It got renewed for season 3. Mike White hinted that it is going to be centered potentially around Eastern religion and death. So I mentioned White Lotus Thailand. That's a very real possibility of where they could be going for season 3. I'm thinking, you know, Eastern religion, where else could that be? Like maybe Japan, maybe China. I'm down for any of those places, and I want to see more of Daphne. Megan Fahey I didn't even talk about the performances. Megan Fahey as Daphne, brilliant. F. Murray Abraham, hysterical. Jennifer Coolidge, a queen. These gays are trying to murder me, forever ingrained in our pop culture history with this show. Michael Imperioli, welcome back. Like, this, everything about the show was just goddamn amazing. Sabrina, what's her last name? Sabrina Impacciatore as Valentina, a discovery, a find. Everyone was just so good. It's such a good show. Both seasons are on HBO and HBO Max. Like, if you haven't watched the show, literally, why do you listen to this podcast? Turn this off. Stop. Go back and watch the whole thing. And I'm sorry for the major spoilers if you did not watch the show, but that's on you. Okay. So very quickly, let's talk about the premieres and finales this week. It is already Monday. This is coming out very late on Monday. But Baking It season 2 premiered on Peacock. It's also tonight getting a preview on NBC. Tomorrow, Tuesday, the Dr. Seuss Baking Challenge arrives on Amazon, and Kindred releases on FX on Hulu. Wednesday, we're getting National Treasure Edge of History, the new National Treasure spinoff series. The first 2 episodes premiere on Disney Plus. On Thursday, The Game returns to Paramount Plus. Peacock has a new dating series called Love for the Ages. The Beauty and the Beast 30th anniversary celebration with Josh Groban and Her airs on ABC. And then it's followed by their new series, The Parent Test. On Friday, Netflix releases the Noah Centineo series, The Recruit. And this new, like, dance reality competition, Dance Monsters, which looks fucking bizarre, also on Netflix. And then on Sunday, we're getting the premiere of 1923, the second prequel series to Yellowstone, to air on Paramount Plus. This one starring Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren. Okay, finales. Lots of finales because Christmas is soon, so like everything's going on either is going away or it's on fall hiatus. So also, this doesn't include things that are coming back in January. Okay, ready. The Cleaning Lady, The Great Christmas Light Fight, Teen Mom, The Next Chapter, The Voice, The Santa Clauses, Survivor, Too Hot to Handle on Netflix, Lego Masters, The Sex Life of College Girls, Acapulco, Shantaram, The Amber Ruffin Show, Coroner, Step Up High Water, and The Life with Lisa Ling all end this week. Whew, wipe my brow. Okay, finally, my Hallmark Countdown to Christmas recommendation for the week. I think next week I'm going to do a Christmas-centric episode of like some of the new Christmas stuff that I've watched this year, as well as like where to stream some of my old favorites, which I also did last year. And then I'll do a wrap of like my final Hallmark Countdown to Christmas recommendations. But for the penultimate week, I'm recommending The Holiday Stocking, which was on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, and it is an entry in the Mahogany series, which is based on the African-American-centric card line that Hallmark puts out, and it tells Black stories for a Black audience. They did one over the summer called Unthinkably Good Things, or Unspeakably Good Things, I forget which. I should know, I was on the Small Town Failing podcast recapping and discussing that with Joe, so feel free to go listen to that. But it is a Mahogany Christmas movie, and it's kind of like It's a Wonderful Life meets Heaven Can Wait. meets Medea in a lot of ways, Medea's family, those movies. So it is about a family that grew up together doing charity at Christmas and have grown apart since then, since their mom died. So it's two sisters and a brother. The brother dies at the beginning of the movie and he becomes an angel. And he gets to go back to Earth to reconcile his sisters, but he can't do it as himself because he's dead. So he gets a pin that makes him see appear human to his sisters, and he brings them together to do this holiday stocking game. And also their name is Holiday, the Holiday family. And he kind of like takes the place of his mother, and he puts riddles in this stocking, which they do leading up to Christmas, and they do charitable acts. And through these charitable acts, they find their way back to each other. And it's like, it's a really sweet story. They kind of botched the ending, I think. There's like better endings they could have gone with, where like RJ, the angel, just kind of disappears when I thought they were going to have him. Like, they all take a picture together, and I thought they were going to have him appear in the picture as the dead brother. But that's not what happened. It's a weird ending that could have been better again. But the whole movie is very sweet, very charming, very funny. It's Tamala Jones, and it's good. It's a feel good movie. It's a reminder to like not be selfish around the holidays, and you know, it's about family connection and you know, thinking beyond yourself basically, and always a great message to be reminded of at the holidays. And also this week's movies were all pretty bad. This was like far and away the best, and even it won't crack my top 10 for the season. But there you have it. This weekend so far have been much better, and I have high hopes for next week's as well. So I might have a, you know, we'll talk about those for the final episode of the season. So there you have it. Thank you all for tuning in to this episode of Fake TV Critic. I'll be back next week with my final episode of 2022 with more recaps, more reviews, more analyses, more discussion. Have a good week, everyone.